Simon & Schuster Audio presents Storm Rising, a thriller by Chris Hawtie. Read by Lisa Flanagan.
For Lauren. It proves more forcibly the necessity of obliging every citizen to be a soldier. This was the case with the Greeks and Romans, and must be that of every free state. Thomas Jefferson, letter to James Monroe, June 19, 1813. Prologue. Waking from a sleep without dreams, the immigrant lies on his back with arms and legs outstretched. Above him, the sky is black and moonless. It's night. Since when? The rotten egg smell of hydrogen sulfide is a clue to his general location. El Norte. But that journey derailed long before now, hadn't it? Thirst forces its way into his consciousness, tongue thick inside his mouth. He becomes aware of an object in his right hand and, seeing the cheap revolver, cannot fathom how it came to be there. Though Luis Pineda comes from a world of many guns, he has never owned one. He hears movement to his left and looks in that direction. Ernesto Cordon sits on the ground some 10 feet away, hunched over and arms slack. Simultaneously, both men become aware of the immense oil storage tank looming behind them, of a security fence around the site's perimeter, topped with razor ribbon, the lights of a nearby town that glow in the distance. "What's happening? Where are we?" asks Cordon in his native language. He massages his head with both hands, but the throbbing pain inside his skull won't subside. Cordon has done drugs back home in Guatemala's city, Zona Viva, and knows all too well the harsh after-effects of home-brewed chemical inebriation. This torment is worse. He comprehends the likelihood that he and his fellow undocumented immigrant have been placed here as stooges, part of some wicked scheme. Why else waste good drugs on two mojados? Luis Pineda releases his grip on the pistol and sits up, his body blocking his companion's view of the weapon. He hasn't survived this long by being incautious. The deaths of two brothers and his father, lost to warring cartel factions in Mexico, drove him north. How much can he trust the Guatemalan, whom he has known for less than a week? Before beginning the journey north, his mother implored him to put his faith in no man, only God. Seeing the backpack, he points for the other man's benefit. Look. Twisting around, Cordon sees the bag propped against the base of the storage tank. Too dizzy to stand, he crawls across gravel to the tank. What is it? Asks Pineda, getting to his feet and shuffling toward his fellow immigrant. Cordon unzips the top of the backpack, peers inside, then recoils as if from something unholy. The top of the backpack remains open. Pineda peers inside, seeing two sticks of gel ignite wired with the firing system and circuit, in this case, a $30 Alcatel flip phone. A bomb? Don't touch it! Back home, Ernesto Cordon had been friendly with the bomb maker employed by gangsters controlling his neighborhood. With that experience, he is an authority in comparison to Pineda. It could be remote controlled, the Guatemalan says with blatant fear. Luis Pineda scans the tank farm as if for lurking conspirators. He sees something worse. Son of a bitch! Another! The second backpack is of a different make, but as battered and dirty as the first. Cordon sees that bag too, and another placed at a third tank down the row. Alarmed, he pushes to his feet. We gotta go, man. Quickly! They both look toward the fence, at the same time seeing a ladder on the ground inside the perimeter. A way out, the ladder is an unexpected miracle. The men move toward the wire and steel fence. A coyote howls in the dark, far distance, closer to the highway, perhaps. The dry wind from the west doesn't relent. Ernesto Cordon stops, frozen in place by a sensation he has experienced before. A feeling of inexplicable dread, as with the dense seconds on a deserted city street before a gunman steps out from shadows. His grandmother, a worshipper of Maximon, proudly attributed his precognition to the family's Mayan roots. Their blood traces back 6 centuries to Gonzalo Guerrero, a shipwrecked Spanish conquistador and slave of Chactamal chief Nachang Khan, who ultimately became the war leader for his captor's clan and fathered the first mestizo children on the continent. In English, Cordon says, "Dude, stop." Pineda pauses, looking over his shoulder and impatient to leave. "Our captors drugged us, left us here. They're watching, waiting for us to try to escape. Then they'll blow the place sky high." These words fail to register with Pineda. Little of his life makes sense anymore. He is tired of taking orders from his fellow immigrant who is 2 years his junior. Only escape matters, nothing else. He must get away from the bombs, all of this oil, the conflagration to come. He moves again in the direction of the fence. A reaction from Cordon, 4 inches taller and 30 pounds heavier, is immediate. "No!" The two men struggle. Pineda breaks free of Cordon's grasp and retrieves the gun from the ground where he left it. Delirious with the blue steel revolver's weight in his hand, the Sinaloan turns, pulling the hammer back with his thumb. "I'm going. Stay if you like." Gambling that Pineda is too timid to fire the revolver, a .38 special with a 4-inch barrel that began life in the U.S. before being smuggled into Mexico, Cordon lunges to take possession of the weapon. The loud bang startles them both, Luis having pulled the trigger by accident. Neither of the men can guess where the round traveled or its destination. Both check themselves for injury, a moment of unintentional comedy. That no one was hurt only emboldens Luis Pineda. He is now a man who has fired a pistol. Pointing the gun at Cordon's head, as he had watched in countless films and television shows, Pineda says, "Voy, pendejo." "I'm going, asshole." Personnel from the FBI and ATF, accompanied by county fire investigators and local law enforcement, cannot enter the site for more than 36 hours after a catastrophic blast that all but obliterated the tank farm. Only 2 of 16 tanks remain intact. With local resources inadequate to the task, a specially trained firefighting team from Louisiana helicoptered in, using foam and water to extinguish the blaze. As the disgorged oil burned, sending black clouds towering overhead, the town of Wink, 3 miles from the site, was evacuated. The concussive blast shattered dozens of plate glass windows along the town's commercial strip, but other than the 2 unidentified victims inside the facility's perimeter, authorities reported no injuries. A weather front that moved into the region overnight has done the job of pushing the black, toxic air south of the border. A crew from the coroner's office in Midland collected the bodies an hour earlier. Yellow surveyor flags that bend and snap back in the swirling hot wind mark the locations where first responders found the victims. Investigators on the scene work methodically in pursuit of answers to a mystery that is only now emerging. As they walk the location in knee-high rubber boots and dark sunglasses, their easy banter masks a terror each of them privately entertains. All can visualize with graphic detail the deaths of the explosion's 2 nameless victims. "We know for sure they were both males?" asks the ATF agent. The county fire investigator nods. "The one at the fence was burnt pretty good. Not much left of that old boy for us to pick over." The federal man turns away from the blackened cyclone fence topped with razor ribbon that partially melted in the fire's prolonged heat blast. He indicates a spot in the ground nearer to one of the destroyed oil tanks. The area is a swamp of partially dissolved foam, oil, and fouled water, putting the investigator's protective gear to a real test. "But the one over that way, he must have been lying flat out on the ground. His front side was mostly intact." "Mostly." An official from the Railroad Commission of Texas squats down next to a second county fire investigator. Together, they studied the slight depression in the ground where Ernesto Cordon sought safety. The bits and pieces there. A fragment of clothing. Scorched boot heel. Clumps of scalp. Tuft of black hair. The RRC official says, "Bagged a 38 over by the fence. This guy, nothing." Company says these two are trespassers. No employees on site for 6 hours prior to the explosion. The hell are they doing here? "No key to get in or out. Just that fucked up ladder," says the ATF man, coming over to join the discussion. Standing a few feet away, a sheriff's deputy from neighboring Reeves County spits into a puddle of smoke-streaked oil. He drove up that morning after a pal with the Wink Police Department had called and asked him to come over for a look-see. Folks in Winkler County in West Texas are tight-knit, prone to help one another out. Especially when the helping is from a man as trustworthy and knowledgeable as Jay Gibbs. "These boys come over from the other side," he says, tipping his head in the general direction of south. These are the deputy's first words to the others, though he has been on site for more than 90 minutes.
"Want to tell the rest of us what makes you so sure?"
the RRC official asks from his heels. The only one not wearing sunglasses, Gibbs points his chin at the ground where Ernesto Cordon died.
"This one might as well wrapped himself in a Guatemalan flag, what with the gold in his mouth. Mayans have been decking out their teeth with jade and such since before there was America."
On his first assignment in West Texas, the man from D.C.-based Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives has a low regard for local law enforcement capabilities. He says, "All kinds of people have gold teeth."
"Yeah, well,"
Gibbs shrugs, not inclined to bump chests with the federal man. The ATF agent glances to his partner, then focuses on Gibbs again.
"So, deputy, you thinking sabotage then?"
he asks with faux incredulity. This low comedy draws a few snickers from the other federal investigators. Jay Gibbs was born and raised in Pecos, about 40 miles to the northeast. Pretty good tight end in high school, he made varsity as a sophomore in a year the football team went 10-4 and undefeated in their district. He's been with the sheriff's office for 3 years and in the Marine Corps, MOS 5811, before that. The deputy squares his hat and looks south again, across a scrubland of sand wash and wire grass to the distant Davis Mountains.
"Could be," he says, playing it straight.
For as long as Gibbs can remember, hard men on both sides of the border have killed one another. For all kinds of reasons. There's always been plenty enough death to go around.
"Question is, who's sabotaging who? Know what I mean?"
1. Taterhole Savings and Loan. Haley Chill's most glaring weakness, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, has been her primary focus for the 12 weeks she's been in camp. Days start with a 10-mile run at sunrise, followed by a healthy breakfast, rest, and then 4 hours of skills training. Nights begin at 7 after a light dinner. For warm-up, she hits pads for 3 rounds. Circuit training follows with double-arm rope slams, dumbbell thrusters, 200-pound sled pulls, and a 60-yard farmer's walk with 80-pound barbells. Twice through, before starting a second circuit. In the last months of her tenure as an aide in the West Wing, Haley gained 15 pounds. Many days in that harrowing time passed without any physical exercise whatsoever. Since leaving the White House, 27 years old and unemployed, Haley Chill is determined to regain the physical fitness of her years in the U.S. Army. Holed up in Princeton, West Virginia, and training 6 days a week at Elite Martial Arts Academy seems as good a way as any to accomplish that goal. Today isn't a typical workout day, however. In anticipation of her first amateur MMA bout later that week, Haley's coach has limited her to stretching and a single sparring session at 50%. The problem is her sparring partner. Almost 6 feet tall with a murderous arm reach, Jewel Rollins ratchets up the intensity with every round. Flustered and stung by a snapping jab that feels like something more than 50%,
Haley retaliates. An amateur boxing champ in the military, she never suffered a loss in the ring. Her strategy when attacked, in the ring and outside of it, is to counterattack. Never relent. Fuck 50%. With her back foot slightly splayed for increased leverage, Haley throws a jab, cross, and then hook at her sparring partner's head. She then feints with her left hand, drops low, and shoots a stiff right, hitting the other woman dead center in her sternum. The perfectly timed jab lands with a thud, catching Rollins as she exhales. The punch might have rocked a fighter with less experience. Haley has put opponents on the canvas with lesser stuff. But Rollins is an NAAFS amateur women's champion. Her mixed martial arts skill set is deep. Haley doesn't see the wheel kick coming until it's too late. If not for thickly padded headgear, the blow would have knocked her out. Fredrik Kozlov steps between the fighters to stop the session, helping Haley to her feet.
You plan to lose, yes?
His cartoonish Russian accent is made less comical by dint of an always-on physical intensity and Olympic gold medal for judo. A back injury short-circuited his transition to professional MMA fighter. Elite martial arts is the top training camp for three states around, and Kozlov's ticket to prosperity in the United States. Winded by her exertions, Haley tucks her chin as if in preparation to throw a jab at her coach. Instead, she shakes her head and fixes her powder-blue eyes on Rollins. Her coach says,
I tell you, 50%. What is wrong with you, stupid?
What about her? Haley asks, gesturing toward her sparring partner.
What about her? Maybe I tell her to go 70% or 100%. Your directions are to go 50%, yes?
Haley stares at the mat, recognizing now that she has screwed up. Again.
You fight your fight!
Kozlov points a sausage-sized index finger at Rollins.
You don't fight her fight! Fight your fight!
Basic stuff. The earliest lesson. Haley can scarcely believe her embarrassing lapse. I was played. What is wrong with me? Kozlov says,
Angry, you are blind. Emotions, you are stupid.
Yes, sir. She can think of nothing more to say, wanting only Kozlov to step aside and open a path to her sparring partner, to redeem herself, if that's possible. But the Russian remains between the fighters. To Haley, he says,
That's enough. Go home. We fix this tomorrow.
Rollins sneers from behind the Russian. Kozlov plants both feet on the mat and anchors his weight, anticipating Haley's loss of temper.
Save it for Friday, Tyolka. You're going to need it.
Her motel is 2 miles east on Oakvale Road. Haley jogs there at a comfortable pace. Past a sub shop, the local Dairy Queen, a Mitsubishi dealership. Losing 15 pounds is only one part of the motivation for finding refuge in West Virginia. Transitioning from amateur boxing to mixed martial arts isn't the whole point either. Haley left a tumultuous Washington, D.C. after a revelation so shattering that escape seemed the only sanity-preserving response. What she found inside a modest brick home across the Potomac River in Arlington destroyed all reverence for the one person she loved most in the world. Without a job or apparent purpose, trapped in a city that never felt like home, her emotional anguish was like a third eye, impossible to disguise. Every waking moment after that fateful Sunday morning in Virginia was filtered through a lens of despair and loathing. Only time and distance would alleviate the pain. The focus and discipline required by her MMA training helped speed the process of mental disassociation. In the meantime, she waits for a call or message from the one man in her life who matters. Not Sam McGovern, the fireman she started seeing before she fled Washington. Not anyone from work, either. Her West Wing colleagues have dispersed, forced into exile after the historical abomination that was the Monroe administration. Future employment in government for any of her White House co-workers would be a miracle. Haley is different.
As a trained operative in a clandestine effort to preserve the nation's constitutional democracy, a kind of deeper state. Her job as chief of staff for the president's senior advisor was only a cover. The phone call she anticipates is from her direct superior in that secret organization, Andrew Wilde, the man who recruited her. He represents a loose affiliation of powerful Washington emeriti, ex-presidents, former Supreme Court justices, retired NSA and CIA directors, senators, and military brass, linked by lifelong government service and unambiguous love of country. There is no official name for this group, nor is there a definitive leader or hierarchy. All members have left their official offices, thereby guaranteeing that their motivations are pure and shorn of self-serving incentives. Few of the participants have ever met each other, their true identities hidden behind pseudonyms. An ultra-secure cloud-based intranet run from a server farm in north-central Canada facilitates communication among members. Though the group has no name, Wilde and other members have come to call themselves Publius, a nod to the Federalist Party formed by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison Jr., and John Jay in support of the still unratified U.S. Constitution. The essence of their cause and entire reason for being is the protection of that hallowed document and its tenets, no matter the origin of the threat to its preservation. Recruited from the U.S. Army, Haley joined the corps of similarly capable individuals to serve as covert agents of Publius. Her first operation, protecting the president and turning him against his paymasters in the Kremlin, was initially an unqualified success. But that mission ended abruptly with Russia's exfiltration of Richard Monroe. A concurrent crisis was devastating cyber attacks that nearly brought Washington to its knees. Had it not been for Haley's initiative, not to mention her extraordinary gift of eidetic memory, the country might have stumbled into a Third World War. Rescuing a besieged U.S. senator from the Capitol when the building was stormed by white nationalists is a cruel punctuation mark on Haley's recent months as an operative for the deeper state. The stress has laid her emotions bare, a mental state further ravaged by family revelations almost too grotesque to imagine. Retreat to her home state of West Virginia, in equal parts beautiful and tragic, has been a soothing balm. God bless the Mountain State. Almost heaven indeed. The motor court-style turnpike motel is low-slung and strenuously well-kept. Older model cars occupy 1 in 5 parking spaces. Newer franchise hotels can be had in town at double the price. But Haley prefers these modest humdrum lodgings. Hyperventilating slightly as she slows her pace and then stops running entirely, the deeper state operative is surprised by her elevated heart rate. Haley bends over and places her hands on her knees for support. A wave of inexplicable fatigue washes over her. She feels sick to her stomach. What the hell is wrong with me? Standing up straight, Haley Chill waits for her heart rate to slow. The shortness of breath dissipates. She opens her room door with a keycard. Stepping inside the darkened room, Haley clocks a figure sitting in a chair by the window and drops into a defensive crouch. Only after recognizing the intruder as her fellow deeper state operative does she relax. Jesus, you startled me. I'm a spook. That's the idea, isn't it? April Wu's apparent ill health, pale and visibly weak, wins her little compassion from Haley, who is displeased by the surprise visit. Are you comfortable? Put your feet up on the bed, why don't you? Sarcasm doesn't suit you, Chill. Clashes with your unabashed earnestness. Haley strips off her trail pack and drops it on the bed. What are you doing here? I'm worried about you. I've seen you do this before, though usually you're breaking stuff. This? This, says April, gesturing at their surroundings. Haley pulls an insubstantial chair out from the sad motel desk, sits. Her silence concedes the point. April smiles, pleased with the win. How was your workout? Light. She considers leaving it at that, but adds, I have my first bout Friday.
Sam coming down? Haley shakes her head. Working. Uh-huh.
Will you stop? He's been here 3 or 4 times.
3 or 4. Must have been extremely memorable. Haley resists an urge to throw a water bottle at her friend.
You look like hell, by the way.
Before her accident, April Wu had been at the mercy of fashion. Pairing ripped jeans with a James Purse t-shirt and Chanel Boucle jacket was as effortless as breathing air. The expense was never an impediment. But today, in this sad, dumpy motel room, April wears tragically banal canvas cargo pants and a black army pullover hoodie. The dark clothing only heightens her sallowness and the circles under her eyes.
I feel like hell.
Wish that car landed somewhere besides on my head.
Me too.
Has the Pope called you? April asks, referring to their superior with the deeper state. Andrew Wilde recruited them both. Haley out of Fort Hood and April from Cyber Command at Fort Meade.
Nothing.
Maybe he can't find you. Haley suspects Publius has the resources to find anyone on the planet, but there's no way of knowing for sure.
I'm training, April, not hiding.
Hard to tell the difference. This has been their way forever. The best of friends and die-hard competitors. April asks,
want to talk about what happened?
You mean that business with the president faking suicide, his exfiltration to Moscow, and unmasking as a Russian mole?
That was fun. But I mean the other thing.
What other thing?
What you found at Charlie Hicks's place,
says April, referring to the House of Horrors in Arlington. The world shifted on that Sunday morning. What didn't change no longer matters. Recovering in the hospital following her accident, April remembers Haley's visit later the same day. The West Virginia native was emotionally shattered. April Wu discovered something new about her friend that day. Haley Chill wasn't invincible after all. I found Charlie Hicks, hanging by his neck, from the bedroom door.
Really? Is that all?
What do you want from me?
The truth.
How much April already knows or doesn't know isn't clear to Haley. This is a given now. As an operative for the deeper state, she can trust no one. Not even good friends inside the organization. Not completely.
Maybe I just don't want to talk about it.
Haley stands and begins to empty the trail pack of her workout gear.
I'm not going away, you know, says April.
I suspected as much. She walks a damp gym towel toward the bathroom.
Are you going to win Friday?
Can't remember the last time I lost, Haley says as she disappears into the bathroom.
She wasn't ready,
the Russian thinks as he watches Haley Chill tap out a fraction of a second before she loses consciousness. 3 months wasn't nearly enough time to transform a boxer into a mixed martial arts fighter.
I put her in there too goddamn soon.
The 400 or so spectators at the Withville Meeting Center certainly got their money's worth, that's for sure. Haley and her opponent, a skilled 22-year-old Filipina with lightning bolts for hands and an impressive ground game, gave the jubilant fans 3 rounds of non-stop cage-rattling warfare. Absurdly overmatched, Haley Chill showed a truckload of heart in the defeat. Her Russian coach can't recall another student with a greater capacity for absorbing pain. But courage can't make up for a catastrophic deficiency in expertise and spotty conditioning. Assuming she is down in points after the first 2 rounds and feeling an unexpected fatigue, Haley gambled at the outset of the 3rd round. She rolled the dice when all that matters are skills, conditioning, and talent. Crouching below her opponent's torso level, Haley propelled herself forward and wrapped her arms around the Filipina's thighs for a double leg takedown. Failing to work her rear leg to the outside, the deeper state operative exposed herself to an all but inevitable guillotine choke.
What happened?
Lying on her back, Haley cannot process the events of the past 60 seconds. Breathing is difficult. Did the chokehold bruise her esophagus? An inexplicable exhaustion. She felt fatigued even in the earliest minutes of the bout,
envelops her. Haley tries to speak but finds it difficult to form the words. Kozlov crouches over her.
Shut up. Don't try to talk, he says.
Copy that, coach. No problemo. Haley has enough experience in combat trauma training to understand the Russian is assessing her ability to maintain focus on him.
She's okay, Kozlov says to someone out of view.
Her eyes are on her coach and never leave him. The Russian observes his fighter's difficulty swallowing.
Throat hurt? That's normal, Tyolka. You're going to be okay.
Did I just lose? I don't lose.
Flat on her back, she is confused by an unavoidable truth.
I got beat.
Let's move. Next fight, ready to go.
Haley can't see who says this, but knows it must be the referee.
Kozlov and others get her to her feet. She experiences a fleeting victory in the ability to put one foot in front of another.
What happened?
Haley asks, articulating these words, another small triumph. The Russian can't hear her above the crowd's racket as they make their way up the mobbed aisle, but he can guess the nature of her question.
Too soon. I put you in too soon, Tyolka.
The deeper state operative shakes her head, angry.
I put myself in there. It was me.
Just as well she doesn't talk. Even breathing hurts. All Haley wants right now is to get away from the avalanche of jeers falling on her. Before walking through the doors that lead to the temporary locker room, she sees April standing next to the doorway, making another appearance. Spectator to Haley's first ever defeat. April Wu, sickly pale and looking every bit the victim of a car accident that she is, wears the most inscrutable expression. Is it pity in her eyes that Haley sees? Or something worse than pity?
Everybody loses. Everybody. Believing you cannot lose is the worst thing for a fighter.
The Russian's thick accent undercuts the effectiveness of his consoling words.
Yes, sir, I know.
Haley's voice is still raspy and raw. Talking makes the pain worse, but she must have this conversation.
I made one mistake. It cost me the match.
Kozlov shakes his head. Driving them home in his 10-year-old Ford Explorer, the Russian dreads what lies ahead. These 45 miles will seem like 300. Having made similar drives, he is all too familiar with the elongation of time after one of his fighters loses in the octagon.
Too soon. You were not ready.
Haley can scarcely believe what he's saying. She has always worked hard enough to avoid this gut-wrenching disappointment with herself. Always. Until tonight. And why couldn't she shake this goddamn fatigue during the fight? Haley says,
I don't understand. It happened so quickly.
Just this once, the Russian would prefer not to coach. Driving back to Princeton in silence would be the better thing. Some music, perhaps. Under his breath, Kozlov says in his native language,
Why not shut up, girl? Take pride in trying.
Trying isn't good enough.
He is stunned to hear his native language come out of Haley's mouth.
You speak Russian?
She nods, letting him flounder in his embarrassment. Kozlov realizes how little he knows Haley Chill. In what other ways has he underestimated her? Anxious to make amends, he says,
With more time and training, you can be good. Very good. But you need more time, Tyolka.
How much time?
6 more months, maybe. A year would be best.
He sees enormous potential in Haley and wouldn't have agreed to train her if he didn't. But the octagon has a way of revealing delusions for what they are, as they did tonight. Haley wishes she had a year. Developing expertise in mixed martial arts appeals to her sense of discipline. The world of MMA is inspiring, the people and their dedication to craft. But a trap door has been sprung. April's surprise visit triggered it. The Russian feels Haley's impatience emanating off her like radioactivity. He was once like her. It's how he broke his back and derailed a promising professional career.
Tish, Yiddish, Dalsh, Budish.
In his heavily accented English, he says,
Ride slower, advance further.
The old proverb fails to resonate. Her loss tonight stings, and Haley will feel its bite for many nights to come. She wishes she could talk with April. Now is the time for an honest conversation. Only her fellow deeper state operative could understand. But by the time Haley emerged from the locker room after her match, April Wu was gone. Vanished again. I'm a spook. Kozlov drives them north. With a negligible moon, darkness envelops the hills and trees beyond the road's shoulders. Haley fixes her gaze on the road ahead, avoiding her reflection in her side window. She enters the cheerless motel room, her home for the past 94 days. Low ceiling, puke-colored drapes pulled shut. An ice machine rumbles to a start on the other side of the wall. The mechanical racket is both sign and signal. Haley realizes she is done here. She recalls her friend's words. I've seen you do this before, though usually you're breaking stuff. Haley hoped she would find April Wu sitting in the chair by the window. The disappointment of not seeing her there is a sharp ache. She considers calling Sam, most likely asleep at this hour, but resists the impulse. In the morning, Haley promises herself. She will call him then. Packing will take minutes. The roads should be clear the whole way home. If Haley leaves in the next 30 minutes, she'll be back in Washington by sunrise. Then the real work can begin. Ride slow? Not a chance. The brick one-story home on 5th Street in Arlington, Virginia, has suffered from a lack of occupancy since she was last here. A broken front bedroom window. Lawn overgrown and spiked with henbit weed. A newly planted for sale sign swings with every gust of wind. More than dreams have died in this place. Haley parks behind a roll-off dumpster out front. She turns off the engine and looks toward the silent house. Hoping to see what? 4 months ago, she came here to ask Charlie Hicks about her father's death in the Second Battle of Fallujah. The man had ducked her at his Pentagon office. Here, at his house, Tommy Chill's war buddy refused her entry. They conversed through the front door instead. Hicks, emotionally distressed and likely suffering from PTSD, provided no new information. Haley left the property, resolved never to bother the man again. But new intelligence suggesting Charlie Hicks had been directly responsible for her father's death altered that resolve. Sitting behind the wheel of her Volkswagen, she recalls a second visit to the house last spring. National calamity had been averted, her mission for the deeper state successfully concluded. The matter of Charlie Hicks's role in her father's death, however, remained unresolved. Sam drove her across the river, but Haley insisted he stay in the car. For this final confrontation with Tommy's war buddy, she was determined to go it alone. There was no answer when she knocked on the door, already ajar. Haley sensed what had transpired before seeing the body. But what she could not have predicted was finding her father hanging by the neck from a bedroom door. Not Charlie Hicks. Haley can remember every detail of the horrific moment. Standing in the hallway, staring at the body, her mind reeled, struggling to process what her eyes were seeing. Tommy Chill didn't die in Iraq. He returned home from the war. But how? Under the assumed identity of another man? That explained why Hicks steadfastly avoided meeting her face to face. For whatever reason, her father had chosen to separate himself irrevocably from his old life, from his wife and children, and live an alternative life in Arlington, Virginia. And what of the real Charlie Hicks, Tommy's war buddy? Was it his body parts that they buried in the family plot back home in West Virginia? That possibility lent the conspiracy a deviously logical symmetry, of course. But there was something worse, a conjecture almost too horrid to contemplate.
Did my father kill Charlie Hicks in order to steal his identity?
What circumstances would drive him to do such a thing?
In the moment, Haley was unwilling to consign the memory of her father to these shocking, shameful circumstances. Better to let Tommy Chill exist in an earlier, near-golden incarnation that she remembers from her youth.
Haley did not call the police to report his suicide, but instead fled the house and its impenetrable mysteries. Those unanswered questions chased her back to the car and away from that awful place. Ignoring them eventually drove the deeper state operative to her spider-hole existence in Princeton, West Virginia. For all of those days, weeks, and months, Haley has avoided confronting the ambiguities of her father's suicide. She didn't know the house in Arlington was put up for sale by an untraceable trust. If Tommy inherited family members with Charlie Hicks's stolen identity, Haley guesses they must be distant and never in her father's life in any meaningful way. How else would it have been possible to perpetuate his fraudulent scheme? That was then. Haley has run long enough. She's returned once again to the House of Horrors, unafraid of the answer she might find there. Exiting her car, Haley approaches the 8-foot-tall roll-off dumpster nudged up against the curb. Gripping the top edge, she hoists herself up to look inside. The jumble of discarded furniture and other household items fill the bin to near capacity. Seeing her father's belongings reduced to this slag heap is like a knife thrust into her heart. Throwing one leg over the side of the dumpster, Haley clambers down inside. Standing precariously on a wooden kitchen chair, she takes inventory of the rubble. A busted lamp, stacks of smashed dinnerware, shattered picture frames, busted bookshelves. Haley ignores all of it. She's in search of information. Clues. Whoever cleaned the house in preparation for its sale would have no use for her father's papers, unpaid bills, and other documentation. If they are in this dumpster, she will find them. Working her way down the loaded container's length is dirty, hot work on a morning when the temperature is already in the high 80s. Haley can't thoroughly inspect the bins every nook and cranny without displacing large, often unwieldy household objects. A mattress and box spring prove especially problematic, weighed down by a 2-seat sofa and collapsed bookshelf. After 20 minutes of labor, a winded and exhausted Haley pulls free a pile of dusty curtains and reveals a large plastic trash bag underneath. Tearing a small opening in the bag confirms that she has found the final resting place of her father's papers. Haley tosses the bag out of the dumpster and clambers over the side. Dropping to the street's pavement, she retrieves the stuffed garbage bag and deposits it in the back seat of her car. Having gained entry through the home's back door by breaking the lowest window pane, Haley smells immediately the commingled odor of disinfectant and fresh paint. All the cupboard doors are open, revealing empty shelves. Glue traps at each corner of the room lie in wait for their next rodent victim. Leaving the kitchen, the deeper state operative enters the similarly desolate living room. There's nothing here for me. For no better reason than morbid sentimentality, Haley enters the hallway that leads to the two bedrooms. She stops short of the primary and experiences again what she cannot repress. Her father, hanging by the neck from the bedroom door, his head tilted at an unnatural angle. The chair lying on its side beneath his body. The pungent smell of his post-mortem evacuations. Transported to the past, Haley resists an urge to look away. Remember this. Another memory drops. One much older but sparked by this newer image. A recall of family lore, the idiosyncratic customs fostered by a clan. And what Haley remembers is the place where Tommy Chill would secure cash, the family nest egg, at a time in their lives when banks were an unattainable luxury. For as long as she can remember, that secure vault in their West Virginia home was below the kitchen floorboards. What her father affectionately nicknamed the Tater Hole Savings and Loan. She retreats up the hallway,
back through the living room and into the kitchen. Dropping to her hands and knees, Haley examines the wood flooring. At first glance, the narrow planks appear permanently seated in place. Tracing her fingers across the grooves between the planks, she applies pressure to one board after another and at different points in their lengths. One piece, of shorter dimension by virtue of its position by a far wall, flexes and shifts. With a knife she retrieves from her pocket, Haley pries the short plank up with modest effort. A hole has been cut in the subfloor, revealing a space between the floor joists and its sole offering, a manila envelope. Haley removes the 8x10 envelope from its makeshift vault. Written in pencil across the front are two words: The Storm. The Deeper State operative opens the envelope and removes four typewritten pages inside. A brief examination of the papers reveals their contents are composed in a book cipher. Rows and rows of incomprehensible 1, 2, or 3-digit numbers fill every page. What do the seemingly random numbers mean? Without the corresponding key, a unique text or document, the pages are impenetrable. Instead of finding answers at the house in Arlington, Haley has only generated more mystery and questions. She replaces the floorboard and leaves the house through the kitchen door, taking the envelope with her. The contents of the trash bag, utility bills, financial statements, and junk mail are now stacked and categorized on the dining table in her Logan Circle apartment. Haley has given the most scrutiny to telephone bills and credit card statements, highlighting some entries and entering the information on her laptop. A broad outline of her father's daily life has emerged: what Tommy did on his days off, where he shopped for groceries, how often he traveled and to what destinations, his most frequent contacts. The picture that materializes of her father's final 6 months is relentlessly monotonous: the lonely existence of a solitary man. Nowhere in these scraps of paper is there clarification of why he had killed himself, why he had taken the life and identity of Charlie Hicks. The truth seems unknowable, like the dark side of the moon. Tommy Chill rarely deviated from his routine. Friday dinners at Harachita on Glebe Road, a movie every other week at the Parks Mall, an unlikely passion for pickle ice freeze pops from Walmart. Details accumulate, forming a small mountain of data that reveals little of the man's real substance. But a few nuggets Haley has found in the scraps of paper hold some promise. Her father made 3 trips to El Paso, Texas in the past year, staying at a motel near Fort Bliss and spending some time at that military installation, as evidenced by receipts from the post exchange. Other receipts suggest 3 trips to a local strip joint. Haley can find no clues that suggest Tommy visited similar establishments here in Arlington, or anywhere else for that matter. She speculates these stops at the Aphrodite Gentlemen's Club north of El Paso were meetups. In the months since Haley discovered her father hanging by the neck in the sad, modest house in Arlington, the most obvious questions have gone unanswered. Tommy Chill could not have assumed the identity of another Marine without help. Why do so in the first place? What is the storm? Some kind of malevolent plot? Was her father a participant? Others must be part of the conspiracy, probably working from within the U.S. military. The nature of the scheme and its agenda remain a complete mystery. Might she find answers in El Paso, Texas?
You couldn't call to let me know you were back in town?
When the intercom buzzed, announcing a visitor downstairs, Haley knew in an instant who had come calling on a weeknight after 10 p.m. Wouldn't be the first time Sam McGovern drove by her place, saw the lights on, and stopped for a surprise visit. Opening the door to him brought a rush of emotions. Their embrace was awkward, almost tentative. Sam knows what's coming and has known it for a long time. That awareness doesn't make it easier before she actually speaks the words. Haley steers him away from the dining table, inundated with papers and mail from the house in Arlington, and into the living area. I was going to call. Tonight.
What is all that? He asks, gesturing toward the table.
My dad's stuff.
Sam sits on the sofa.
You went back there?
He asks, incredulous. Haley remains on guard. The next several minutes are a minefield. Yeah. She pulls over a chair from the dining area, close enough to smell the fire on him. Sam can read her expression. He tenses his t-shirt for a sniff.
Sorry, busy night. 3 jobs.
Haley has always loved that. Jobs is what Sam and his cohorts from the DCFD Engine Company 5 call the fires they extinguish. Car fire, trash fire, dwelling fire. All are jobs. And Sam, assigned to a ladder company, he is a truckie. From the beginning, she has envied him for his chosen profession. A firefighter's task is so unambiguous, the measure of accomplishment so clearly defined. The inherent good of what he does cannot be second-guessed, unlike the murk of her role as a deeper state operative. Last spring, when Haley emerged from the house in Arlington, Sam McGovern was waiting in the car. She didn't have to say what she found inside for him to know it was terrible. Haley resisted speaking of it then. Not that day or the next. But eventually she opened up to Sam, divulging the barest details of her father's stunning reappearance in her life and his subsequent suicide, because all she had were the barest details. Haley told him nothing about the wider conspiracy she was only now beginning to suspect might be afoot. Doing so would have necessitated informing him about her association with Publius. And the absolute necessity of keeping her double life a secret from Sam is the most compelling reason why Haley must stop seeing him.
Given how upset you were that day, I'm kind of surprised you went back.
I tried to let it go, but I can't. Not without finding out the truth.
Sure you can.
She shakes her head, emphatic. That's not the way this is going. With me just rolling with it.
And your MMA training? What was that?
Haley doesn't answer, not inclined to tell him she had fought her first amateur bout and lost. Sam takes her silence at face value.
Okay, got it. Anything else on that list?
What list would that be?
The list of all the things you can't or won't tell me. The secrets list?
Oh, hell, Sam, I don't know.
Yes, you do.
This guy, she thinks, a real American hero. I'm sorry.
There's nothing to be sorry about.
I'm
marking down an explanation as completely unnecessary,
he says, more or less interrupting Haley. She anticipated he would be this composed, that Sam would let her off the hook, his magnanimous nature. And of course, this fact makes having to break it off with him that much worse. Thank you.
Sam gestures toward the dining table and stacks of receipts, utility bills, and credit card statements.
Find anything interesting?
Maybe.
What happens after you discover the truth?
Nothing. Then it's over.
No.
No, what?
It's never over. The truth leaves its stink on you like 3 jobs did on me today.
Have it your way, then.
That's just the way it is.
He seems cross now, passing through the phases of profound disappointment and regret at breakneck speed.
You never really gave this a fair shot, Haley.
Agreed. I didn't. Give a fair shot, I mean.
Look, if it's time you need, that's cool. I get how insanely upsetting all of it must have been. Must be.
She stares at the floor between them. He deserves my time. Sam deserves my respect. He's one of the good ones, a real hero.
Haley looks up again, meeting Sam's gaze. Which is why I think I fell into this thing with you. After all of that craziness, I had to hold on to something.
Her words are hardly mollifying. Okay.
Where I'm going, she falters. Unsure how to describe a world she can only intuit at its very broadest outlines. I think this will be a very dark road.
Then I should come with you.
Haley shakes her head.
He says,
if it's so bad,
stopping himself because he senses he has found the boundary between what is allowed and what is forbidden to him. Sam has always known Haley Chill was more than a mere White House staffer. He realizes this is the reason she will go it alone. Why she has always been alone. Even in the scattershot moments they were together. She looks at him now, able to meet his gaze without guilt or shame. She knows he knows.
Okay, Sam says. Somehow, just saying that much is easiest.
Later, lying in bed, the city outside the window dark and impossibly silent, Sam asks,
"So, El Paso?"
"I'm not sure yet."
A pause then.
"Maybe."
"And if you don't go, then what?"
"I don't know." "This is good enough," he decides. "Good enough."
Haley says, "I need to sort it out. Tomorrow." A promise she makes to herself.
"Whatever made your dad do what he did, it can't be good. Going down there, it's not safe."
"I can take care of myself." He has heard this from her before. A thing between them.
"It's my nature to help." With a smile, he adds, "I'm literally a lifesaver."
"I know." She kisses him. Again.